You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrts.
Well, thanks for joining us today. I am Lindsay Ehrts. Let's go inside Utah politics. We begin our program with a federal trade court blocking the president from imposing sweeping tariffs under emergency powers. The ruling from a three-judge panel weighing multiple lawsuits over the regime of the Trump administration at the New York-based Court of International Trade. Now, tariffs typically have to be approved by Congress, but the president has argued that the country's trade deficits amounts to a national emergency. Now, the court rejected that argument, finding the president has exceeded his authority. Now, the White House argues the opposite, that it's the court that is overstepped here, and they are likely planning an appeal. Well, joining me to sort this all out, Rusty Cannon with the Utah Credit Association and Sarah Real. She's with the State Board of Education. Want to point out that both of you, neither of you represent your organizations here, so appreciate you coming on to share your personal insights and expertise on all of these topics. Rusty, let me start with you. This trade court that made this ruling, how much stock do we put into it and what happens from here?
Well, it's an important court. It actually is a court. A lot of us hadn't heard of it until now,
sure.
But it's a federal court that deals with these matters specifically. So this does matter for him and for his administration. It stops a portion of his tariffs. It really comes down to what do you call a national emergency? The president is saying, I'll call whatever I want a national emergency, and the court's saying, no, this in our view doesn't amount to a national emergency. There are some powers that they left in place where he can keep some of the tariffs. But basically, in my opinion, politically for him, this could be a way out on some of the tariffs.
Sure.
I would welcome it as someone who's voted for him three times, hope he succeeds. This has been an unmitigated disaster, his push on these tariffs.
And how is it an emergency, if I can just push you a little bit, if we've been dealing with the deficit for years and years, decades?
Yeah, that's where his argument doesn't hold water. Okay, all of a sudden it's an emergency. It wasn't an emergency in your first term. All
sure.
of a sudden it is. It doesn't hold water. So I think this is another way for the courts to weigh in and say, hey, hold on, this power really is vested with Congress. You need to go through them. They're letting some stay in place, but others that he's got to pull back on. I again think this is just a way that he has really ruined the first part of his presidency. His ratings dropped significantly after that, you know, day of liberation and all of that. There's been a bit of rebound now as he paused them. Maybe this is a way out for him and his administration. I doubt he'll go down that road. He will kick and scream, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, so it's the tariffs that he imposed on certain countries that will pause right now, but tariffs on goods like aluminum, steel, car parts, stuff like that,
yeah.
those will continue.
Security risk ones stay in place. Those are under a different section of law.
Sure.
Two different acts of Congress from the 60s and 70s. It gets a little bit complicated. So, yeah, some of those will stay. The extraordinary tariffs on that day where he held up the chart, those should all be paused at this point.
Okay. Sarah, how does this impact people? I mean, even down to Utah's small businesses, how do these tariffs, and even this pause, this kind of ping-ponging, how does this impact people?
Yeah, I look at this as more of a bigger picture. It's two pieces. One is, how do we govern and what precedent are we setting? And I don't like a lot of the precedents that we're setting. I don't like seeing the executive branch taking a lot more power than we normally have seen historically in our country. That's the first piece. And then the second piece is that we are seeing the deficit rise under Republican presidencies, and that is just a fact. And so I would really like to hear folks that talk about the deficit really show me that they care about lowering the deficit when we haven't seen that in the last Trump administration and in this one.
Let's move to the deficit conversation, because this week as well, Elon Musk stepping down from his role as overseeing of DOGE, the government efficiency department, where we added people in the government to cut the government funding, right? It's kind of that that question. But what does DOGE look like without Elon Musk?
It's the part that I'm thinking about with this is, how much of an ear does he still have of the president, right? And if he still has a lot of power in the way that he his relationship with the president, then we might see DOGE continue to keep power, or we might see DOGE just trickle away. It was a big hoopla at the beginning of his presidency, and now it's just going to kind of fade away into the dark. I don't know.
Rusty, what do you think? What happens to DOGE here?
I think Elon Musk learned some very valuable lessons, is that politically things work differently. I think they really stepped in a lot of things that they shouldn't have. The key now is, will Congress put a rescissions package together that will lock in some of these efficiency cuts? It might be about $9 billion. That is a far cry from $1 trillion, but at least it's something. The one thing that I have appreciated with their effort is, at least it's open conversations about things like USAID. Most people didn't know what that was, what was going on there. That was helpful. Even if that's all that comes from it, I'm grateful that it's been that way. But I think Elon became, I think unfairly, a bit of a target. But he can go back to doing what he does and make some money back because he's lost a lot during that period. I think a lot of this will be forgotten about, unfortunately, fairly soon, unless Congress continues it. But let's be honest, Congress doing something substantial in any way is unlikely.
Do we think this had anything to do with Elon's criticism of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill in recent days? This was a scheduled departure, right? It was only supposed to last like 130 days or something to that effect, his time
I personally don't think it was, just because it was timed out. If he goes longer, he has financial disclosures and things. He basically becomes an employee of the federal government, which he doesn't want to do. I think the timing is just sort of unfortunate with his other criticism. Maybe he feels like he can do that now if he's on a way out anyway.
Well, and to Sarah's point, how much of the president's ear does he still have? And what do the cuts look like going forward?
Yeah, and we have to think about, you know, do we want government to work in a way that's thoughtful, which is oftentimes very frustrating because it moves very slow. We ask for a lot of input. We go through a lot of different processes and red tape. Do we want that when we look at cuts and things that we're considering on the table? Or do we want to do more of the blunt force, Doge-type cuts? And I tend to lean more towards being thoughtful about a lot of the things that we're cutting, but I do agree that we need to make some cuts.
So some of the cuts in the Big Beautiful Bill include this conversation around Medicaid and other social services programs that help the least among us, right? The poor, the elderly, right? Yeah. People on Social Security, stuff like that. But Republicans are often arguing for a real look at these. The way we're cutting them in the Big Beautiful Bill, is that the real look we should be taking?
Well, it's incumbent upon Republicans to message better. I think they've lost this battle so far, but hopefully they can regain a little bit of a lead. The cuts, as they're called, what they're trying to put in is work requirements. Mm-hmm. So what doesn't get often repeated is Obamacare, when it was passed, allowed any able-bodied adult to get onto Medicaid if they wanted to in certain circumstances. Since 2010, you've seen about 20 million able-bodied adults added to Medicaid. You juxtapose that with about 2 million children, so about 10 times the amount of able-bodied adults. That now takes up the majority of the budget, meaning 35% of the budget goes to that, 30% or so goes to children, and divide it up from there. The idea behind making those able-bodied adults that don't have dependent children work 20 hours a week, we think is reasonable, and then that pushes them off of those roles and then helps that money go to who it matters, who it should be used for, which is elderly, children, disabled, those types of things. We think that is something that most people would support, but you know, as a Republican myself, the messaging has been off. They need to do a better job of saying, hey, no, that's not what we did. We didn't cut it. We put in work requirements, and here's why we think it makes sense.
Sarah, are there too many people on Medicaid's rolls that are getting services from the government that shouldn't right now?
Yeah, I tend to disagree, only because I think that I think we need to make bigger tax cuts to the wealthiest people in our country. And I think that that would provide a lot of funding. I think that taking away...
Did you mean tax hikes? You said tax cuts.
Tax hikes.
I was like, I'm all in.
So what I want is I want the rich to be richer. No, yeah. No, I'd like to see tax increases on the wealthiest in our country. I think we could see, you know, it's like the Elizabeth Warren method, and I see that working really well rather than messing with a structure and taking away and potentially a lot of people's health care.
Does that do anything for you, Rusty? Obviously, you're going to disagree with that.
I know. Yeah.
And it's fine. And tell me why.
It's just something, two different schools of thought. But
sure.
I think we have quite some time until the midterm elections, but Republicans have to get the messaging back because they'll lose on that messaging unless they make it clear of, hey, there's nothing wrong with asking a 29-year-old able-bodied male to go work for 20 hours a week if you want to continue on.
How do we determine if they're able-bodied?
Under the definition in the bill, there are exemptions, you know, for if you're pregnant, have other extraneous circumstances. It should just be 19 to 64, able-bodied. You do need to work at least 20 hours a week.
Okay.
You know, to continue.
And I'll add, it's surprising to me that Democrats have been able to pull that message out to show that the Republicans aren't messaging well, because historically Democrats are really terrible at messaging. And so the fact that they've even been able to call them on their poor way of messaging, that is truly remarkable.
Let's, in our final minutes, switch to a local issue here that's been bubbling for the last year and a half since we had an election in 2024. There's been issues over signature gathering in the Governor Cox's campaign and Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson's campaign. This past week, there was a legislative hearing where a couple of the people on the forefront of those allegations that there weren't enough signatures collected to get on the ballot for the campaign presented to a legislative committee, sort of rehashing some of their allegations. In the days since, Lieutenant Governor has been getting some threats online. we call them death threats for lack of a better word. I know there's a legal definition of death threats, but what do you guys make of these? What do you make of the rhetoric around this continued conversation around signature gathering and where it's escalated to?
Well, first of all, on the subject of signature gathering, it just doesn't hold water. One person who tried to get signatures for the governor's race, Phil Lyman, right? There are many people that try to get signatures. I think the argument is old and tired. The fact that threats are being issued in any way like that through whether it's Twitter or whatever, they're wrong. Our lieutenant governor has had way too much heat on this. It's unfair and it's improper. I think it speaks to the unfortunate discourse that we're in these days politically, especially on social media. There's really not a lot of downside to just posting whatever you want, and it can be pretty ugly out there. And so it should end. It's ridiculous. Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And, you know, when I was in high school, I lost the state softball championship tournament because of a base running error, and I lost, and I got over it. I lost an election,
Did
and I got over
cheat?
It.
Did
no one cheated. I didn't go, you know, throw a fit and fight about it. I mean, at some point, I think it's great to, you know, have that discourse and disagree and, like, you know, make sure that our elections are secure, which they are, but then you got to get over it and move on.
They're arguing that there are some validity to their claims, arguing that they found missing signatures. Again, I didn't see the evidence of where the signatures went missing. There were some submitted for fraud. I think the allegation is that perhaps some fraudulent signatures made it into the governor's packet. The audit is found an error rate, right? So it could have been possible that he didn't get enough signatures, but statistically, it's likely that he did, right? Yeah. And signatures are inherently subjective, right? So every time someone reviews them, they're going to get a different number. I mean, what do you just make of their allegations?
I don't think they hold water because the governor had thousands of signatures in the waiting that you could just continue to oversubmit. The counters have to move on to another race. They can't just continue to count. So once you hit that threshold of 28,000 plus a few, okay, let's move on and count some other ones. He could have easily just over-submitted and gone well over the hurdle. That's just not the way the system works. And so you can grasp at straws saying, yeah, but just I don't think it holds water. And frankly, I think the conversation is getting old.
Yeah, and I think it's completely inappropriate to be making death threats to the lieutenant governor. She does an outstanding job. Our elections are secure. Utahns getting this information and being worried about our elections being secure and the processes, it's really bad. It's really, really bad for the biggest right we have, which is our right to vote.
We will leave it there. Sarah Real with the State Board of Education and Rusty Cannon with the Credit Union Association. We appreciate your time today and all of your insights. Well, still ahead on Inside Utah Politics, the governor unveiling new housing plans. Hear how he answered our questions in front of all the Utah press. That's coming up next.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, Governor Spencer Cox is unveiling a new state dashboard to help keep track of his administration's goal of building 35,000 starter homes over the next 4 years. So far, he says they've built about 5,100. Now, he admits it's a lofty goal, but this week he joined with dozens of local mayors to outline how cities and the state are working together on this. However, like all things in politics, the plan, not without its critics. Questions of local control loom large over the state's plans. We're going to play for you now in full the governor's back and forth with reporters.
We're happy to take a few questions.
Elaborate on how this kind of, like, what actually we're going to do policy-wise.
Sure.
I'm wondering how your kind of executive order that you did the other day and the council plays into this, because you're trying to coordinate all these state agencies to develop projects and develop housing. Is it sort of like the Beehive Development Agency in that regard?
And then no, it has nothing to do with that.
How do you work with this local control and what these mayors want to do versus what the state is saying you need to do?
Yeah, so the purpose of the build council that you're referring to from our executive order, it has nothing to do with the Beehive Development Agency. That's I heard that this morning. I don't know who thought that, but no, it's extremely different. The purpose of that is just to coordinate all the efforts that are actually happening out there when it looks at, so there are planning efforts happening in different parts of the state. Different organizations. There's state planning efforts, multiple state planning efforts. We have our universities who are doing planning efforts. We have regional councils that are doing planning efforts. And oftentimes they're not talking to each other. So one will come out with a plan and then someone else comes out with a plan and they never talked about those two plans. So really, I mean, it's not just another meeting. I don't want to defile it like that at all. But it is to get the high level people who are doing these plans just in a room together to talk about, oh, you're doing this, we were doing this. Let's see if some ideas can come together. What today is about is about finding those best practices. You'll often hear me, and I'm guilty of this, and I've made this point. We talk about the bad actors a lot, where there are a few cities here and there that aren't approving plans, that are taking years to get things done, that are very purposely driving up costs to make it so development can't happen. And yet we have dozens and dozens and dozens of cities who are doing this the right way. And we want to learn from each other. One of our good mayors talked about how, Mayor Silvestrini talked about how we have, you know, we have about 250 really experiments going on in this state, 250 different communities where they're doing this work. But oftentimes we don't share the wins, the things that are happening. So part of what we're trying to do, and this dashboard is part of this as well, so everyone can see what's happening, so we can learn from each other. Spanish Fork has approved some incredible projects, some multifamily projects, some density projects in certain parts of their city where it makes sense, where there's infrastructure. How did you get that done? And another city will approve a major development in a 2 or 3 months, where it sometimes takes 2 or 3 years. How are you able to do that so much quicker than someone else? Let's learn from those ideas. So this is really about, instead of kind of that scarcity attack mindset, it's about a collaboration mindset. Let's learn from each other and see if we can't unlock potential for significant housing gains over the next 4 years.
Yeah. You mentioned transit-oriented development, yep. Station area plans. At the same time, the state has taken Salt Lake City Street Authority away. Just yesterday, UDOT blocked a bike lane project at Pioneer Park. Isn't there a mixed message here where you're telling cities to get to work, but you're clipping the city's wings when they try?
Well, I don't know if bike lanes create housing, so I'd say they're
the people
they're
who
different.
Live in the housing tend to use them because they're on the streets in front of their homes.
Sure, and that's a very specific issue in the capital city, which is always a unique issue. The capital city does represent the entire state in ways that are different, and so I can tell you every governor, red or blue, and their capital cities, they have those kind of debates over who gets to decide what's happening in those cities. And that will certainly continue. I don't see them at odds at all when it comes to the housing development that we're trying to build.
Would these mayors be comfortable losing their street authority?
Probably not, but they're also probably not at risk of them losing because they're not the capital city mayors.
Governor, you mentioned weren't up to speed on the 35.
Can I just ask, what was the biggest challenge coming into this meeting, number one? And number two, how will we know whether that challenge was overcome?
Yeah, so the biggest challenge is that we just don't have enough housing, and there is always a tension between the state and local government. When I mentioned you hear what's happening in other states, those are the debates that are happening in California, they're happening in Texas, they're happening in Montana, they're happening in New Hampshire, red states, blue states, where there's this tension that comes between local control, which again, as a former mayor and city council member, I'm very supportive of local control. People understand what happens in their cities and what's best for their cities. And then you have this tension though of sometimes what most people want is, I say this all the time, we all want more housing, we just want it where we can't see it, right? So the incentive structure becomes very difficult on our mayors and city council. I have a tremendous amount of respect, a tremendous amount of empathy for what they're going through. Many of them are signing up to run again, or some of them are signing up or not signing up to run again because of that. City council members as well, they'll do the right thing and approve a development that will benefit future generations, and then there's a referendum and the project gets denied. They get voted out of office because a small, very vocal group of in a neighborhood can be very angry about any type of new housing going in. That's where the real tension is. And so I appreciate their willingness. I pushed on them and they pushed on me. And that's healthy. That's a good thing. We both pushed on the legislature a little bit because there were no legislators here. We love the legislature, and the legislature is doing really important stuff in this space. So that's the tension. That's the tension. Now, how will we know if this is working? Well, over the next 4 years, you'll see it. Either we're getting approvals done quicker, and we're getting houses built, shovels actually in the ground, and people moving into homes, and you'll see first the price of housing level off, and then you'll see it start to decline as we get more homes. We can't hide from this stuff. It may very well be 3.5 years from now that I'm a complete failure because we didn't get any of this done and the price of housing has gone up and all of our kids have moved to Kansas. That's how you'll know if we failed. Conversely, if our kids and grandkids are starting to buy homes here and we continue to create jobs and we continue to create the best standard of living anywhere in the nation, that's how you'll know we've succeeded.
Please.
What needs to be done to get up to speed with the 35,000 starter homes?
Yeah, so there are a couple things that need to be done, and that's really what this was all what we were talking about. So you'll hear we've permitted lots. We've got 5,000 permitted lots here, 10,000 permitted lots here, but they're not being built on yet. And so that's one of the problems is infrastructure. We heard that loud and clear from these mayors today. Even if you have approval for a subdivision, if there's no money for roads, if there's no money for sewer, water, then no lots are going to be built, or no homes are going to be built. So that's an issue. How do we get the infrastructure money where it needs to go, where it can have the greatest impact? And then number two, it's we do have some subdivisions that are in the planning phase right now where they're ready to go, where they could break ground, where we could start building thousands of homes. Some of them under $400,000 that would really help people trying to get into a new home. How do we move those along quicker? That's where we're all trying to get together and figuring out ways to move that much faster. I do want to thank everybody who has been involved in the 35,000 starter home effort. We've moved mountains, but there's mountains still blocking us, and we're trying to get there. Thanks, everybody. We hope you'll pull up the new dashboard, play with it a little bit. We'll keep adding stuff to it. We want locals to know. We hope that we can change the narrative as well. Instead of having people showing up to planning and zoning meetings and city council meetings and yelling at these good people for actually approving new homes, we want the opposite. We want people showing up in droves to say, hey, we need more housing in our town so that my kids can afford to live here. And that's how we're going to change this and actually get stuff done. Thanks, everyone.
Well, of course, questions of housing ultimately come back to land and where we're going to build all these starter homes. So I asked the governor whether we have the land to get it done. Here's what he said.
We have plenty of land. Yep, we do. And again, we're going to have more density in places. We absolutely can do this. And you know, I always hear about water being the issue. When you look at household size, the average household has gone from 5 or 6 down to 2.5. I mean, our household size has changed. So we have bigger homes, but they're using less water. They're using less resources. The technology that we have today can absolutely solve those problems. And we have incredible innovation happening in the housing space. We just need to get everybody together to understand it. So thanks, everyone.
Well, we'll have a link to more reporting on this and the governor's dashboard. That's on our website right now, abc4.com. We'll be right back. Ending with this today, this weekend, the Utah Democrats electing a new party chair and party leadership. But due to the pre-taping deadlines of our program, we can't report on them here for you right now. But to see our full coverage, you can visit abc4.com/politics. That's how you find it. We will be there all day with extensive coverage of party business and the results. Well, that does it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure you reach out. You can always email insideutahpolitics@abc4.com. You can follow along with me on social media. I'm on X, Blue Sky, Threads. Just search for Lindsay on Air, Instagram as well. You can also find our show online in podcast form. So just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz wherever you get your podcasts. Well, thanks for being with us, everyone. We will see you next week.